From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
And welcome back to Little Cuts, our weekly mini-sode where we dig into the things that we've been watching recently. I'm Terry.
I'm Mary Beth. And this week we're chatting about a lot of stuff. I've watched so much stuff this week, and I don't understand what happened. I went from, like, not watching anything to being like, okay, you watched 8 movies in 4 days. But anyway, we're specifically chatting about Alex Garland's new discourse machine, Nightmarish Sleepwalking, Glowing TVs, Mummies and Hot Cult Leaders, a weird slash sad documentaries, and then we do a do-over with Steve Martin.
It's a jam-packed schedule this time, so let's dive in. I am dying to hear about Civil War.
Yes, so I finally saw Civil War last weekend with one of my very good friends, who is not a, like, critic. She is not, like, a cinema person, but she's done a lot of work. I don't, like, fully know how to explain her job because it's one of those DC jobs where, like, I kind of get the gist, but I don't fully get it. But a lot of the work she has done has been doing, like, this crisis index kind of thing about different countries in Africa. So she has been exposed to, like, a lot of really, like, wild stuff and is, like, very, like, into political science, politics, and things like that. So I was excited to see it with her because of her, like, particular work and, like, right, interests in general. And I was like, this will be really interesting to watch from her, like, with her and get her POV on it as someone who is not a film critic, but as rather someone more kind of, like, attached to, like, the real world inspirations that are in Civil War. And so we both had basically, like, read the discourse online. We had both been talking about the discourse online between people not liking it to Andy Ngo's archival footage being used, which is a huge issue, and also thanking a TERF in the credits. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, Helen Lewis is thanked in the credits, and while, like, it's her situation is very strange because, like, she has done a lot of, like, editing of people's work, people who are trans, writing about trans people, but then she also made a statement in 2017 about how, like, trans people are going to, like, increase sexual assaults due to the bathroom stuff and, like, trans people into bath, like, so it's one of these things where it's like she's definitely has, like, TERF. I don't know, it's very weird. Regardless, all of the air around it has just been kind of bad. And so, but I really wanted to see it because I, you know, as a critic, as, like, a film person, I want to be able to, like, make an actual assessment of it before I jump into the discourse, which a lot of people could learn from. Maybe you shouldn't start talking shit about things. I've learned this the hard way. Don't talk shit about things you haven't seen yet because you could be full of shit. And I'm glad I didn't talk shit because I actually really liked Civil War. I went into Civil War, like, dubious. Mm-hmm. And I actually quite liked it. as it is presented in front of me. And that does not mean that I make any excuses for any of the stuff around it.
Right.
Especially in terms of like archival footage used and people kind of used to talk about it. But I also think, and I haven't done as much of a deep dive into this as I could right now, but you know, I just saw it. A lot of the words that Alex Garland has been using to talk about this movie, while I agree that he is kind of being very milquetoast about the political stance of this movie, I also think his words are being taken out of context and also not understood correctly.
That never happens a little bit of both. In today's day and
never,
age.
Never. So, like, there's a lot of weird things that he and the cast are saying that I don't necessarily agree with about this movie, but, like, that's neither here nor there. This movie is perhaps, like, is an incredible depiction of photojournalism and journalism and what it means to engage the conflict without actually engaging with it on, like, a meaningful level outside of, like, you want to get the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are really hung up on the fact that we don't get details about why there's a civil war happening and that it feels like it's not taking a stance on anything. And I just, like, don't agree with that. Inherently, I don't agree with that. I think it is taking a stance, even if it's not, like, it's not, because it's not going, like, fuck fascists. I feel like some people are getting kind of upset.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you watch the movie and kind of like pick up some of the signals they're putting down, you can kind of, you still feel the fuck fascist vibe, but you also feel the like in conflict, everyone sucks.
Yeah.
And I think what's really interesting is watching this with what's going on in Palestine and what's going on with Israel right now, because I have been consuming so much content that is war photography, war video, and that is not a good, I'm not advocating for that. That is really not good for your brain. But like so much of the imagery in this movie feels like it's pulled out of like Instagram things I've seen, which is again, like the nature of conflict. Unfortunately, it's like a cycle that's fucked up that a lot of the same things that happen in one conflict are happening in another. And so like, I think because it is white people, mostly white, there are a lot of people of color in this movie, and there's a lot of interesting like discussions going on about race depictions in this movie, which I think are really valid, but it's a lot of like people being, it feels like people being uncomfortable with it being placed on our soil and putting in our face this directly and confronting. And I think it's like, I don't want to discount anyone's opinions about this movie. I understand it's a very divisive one, but I also think it is saying a lot more than it's being given credit for. And I think it's a really fascinating portrayal of like what happens when you are obsessed with that story of getting that story of being the best and you prioritize human life over that. And what does that mean? And what does humanity look like in these kinds of scenarios? I found it an incredibly well-made film. The sound design is incredible. It's very overwhelming in theaters with like a lot of like the gunshot sounds and explosions.
It looks big for an A24 movie.
So it is, but a lot of the stuff they see that's so big in the trailers are like the biggest parts.
Okay.
So it's obviously very sweeping, but it is not this like crazy action movie with like lots of big action sequences. It's mostly a road trip esque movie with these really fucked up like tableau, like montages and tableaus of things happening. And then there's like a couple big action sequences towards the end. But again, the trailer takes like the biggest moments and kind of like plays with those when it's really not as big as the trailer makes it out to be.
Marketing, right?
I think. Yeah, exactly. Like, there's obviously a lot of like violence and stuff, obviously.
Right.
But again, like big battle sequences, there's not really that.
Okay.
It's a lot of alluding to it, but there isn't as many like war scenes that are like battlefields of people shooting each other. It's a lot of people like dropping in and doing crazy shit on a smaller scale.
Okay.
So,
yeah, I really want to see it. And I think when you were talking, I was just thinking about how we talk a lot on this podcast about media literacy. And I do think that we've become so used to having everything spelled out for us that when a movie doesn't give us all the answers, and I'm saying us as in like the general populace.
Yeah.
It's like
royal us.
Right. The royal we. we have problems with it anymore. And I think that's what's interesting to me is, particularly with like our the main feed of the podcast, where we go through a lot of movies throughout time and sort of seeing kind of where we're at this moment, it kind of makes me sad because this is a sweeping generalization, because there are movies that are definitely operating in that vague, you know, space that we've seen. But like a lot of times the movies that get the big discourse are the movies that aren't showing like fascist bad, this good, taking a side, doing this, spelling it all out for us. And so I don't know, I find it really frustrating as a movie lover and someone that went to school studying English and is very big into like close reading and to figure out what the themes are and to form my own opinion for it and critically think about what the movie is telling me and what my thoughts are for it. And I feel like a lot of movies don't do that, or a lot of people aren't doing that when they interact with film anymore. And it makes me sad, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I agree. Because when I walked out of that movie, I was like, I don't know if I saw the same movie as a lot of people saw, because I don't really I don't see the same issues. And I'm not saying that certain people aren't right, or like right. that their opinions are wrong. Like, I don't mean that by any stretch of the imagination. I just don't. A lot of critiques I've seen, I don't fully agree with, or sometimes don't fully understand.
Yeah.
In terms of like, I did not get that vibe at all watching this movie. And yeah, I mean, it's one of those movies where I understand if you don't want to see it, and I understand
Absolutely.
If you don't want to spend money on seeing it. Like, that's Absolutely. Obviously a fine thing. But I do think it's worth seeing if you are interested at all. Like, in Alex Garland, there's a lot of him paralleling the 28 Days Later imagery in this movie, which I think
okay.
is really fascinating. And how he uses a lot of tropes of, like, zombie and apocalypse movies here. I don't know. I think it's way more interesting than the internet is giving it credit for. So I would recommend you seeing it. If you care enough to, like, about the discourse, I would recommend seeing it if you haven't, to kind of, like, understand the context more.
Yeah. Cool. I definitely want to see it. I've been really bad at going to
see movies
in the theaters.
It's a good theater movie. And again, I understand not wanting to give money to it. Like, I don't disparage that at all. But if I don't feel as bad, because usually with licensing, they just like get like a flat amount, and it's not like my money is going to him. But
right,
again, that is not a rationalization, nor is it an excuse for it at all. I just felt like it was my part of my job as a critic, even though I didn't review it or anything, to like have a more informed opinion about it. And engage with the larger discourse. But not really, because I'm not really I don't really talk about it online, because I'm not really like, oh no, Tony, it did not at all. It didn't come off accusatory at all. I just like haven't waded into it online, because I don't really feel like fighting idiots on the internet about a movie that like,
yeah.
the whole thing is like, hey, don't like fuck with each other. Anyway, Nightmarish Sleepwalking.
So this is
when
I think.
Bad.
It is bad, but I think this is one that you saw. I think it might have played at Fantastic Fest. It's called Sleep. It's a South Korean film.
Oh, okay. I'm very curious to hear what you think about this.
So I really liked it.
I have seen it. I did see it.
Okay. By the way. I really liked it. I think it sort of loses its way a little bit, but then it kind of comes together in the end for me in an interesting way. But I don't think the plot, I think it sort of loses what it's trying to do for a little bit. However, this movie is about a young expectant wife who her husband has started having weird sleep habits. He is sleepwalking. He is sleep eating. He is, at one point early on, he almost throws himself over a balcony. Like, she's having issues with him, whenever he sleeps. And so there's, like, this tension here because she is a pregnant mom and he is acting very bizarre in his sleep. And then, of course, as the movie goes on, there's now a kid in the picture, and all of the attempts that they are doing to try to make it so that he is not sleepwalking at night, or that he is doing things to either not hurt himself or hurt her or hurt the baby. And so there's a little bit of a subtext here about being stuck with someone that is alternately, you know, a loving husband, but then also abusive, even though from his perspective, this is not something that he is actively trying to do. It just happens. But there's an interesting interplay there between the supernatural-esque type thing that's happening and also like someone being stuck in a bad situation and not knowing how to protect herself or her kid. So it goes into some weird territories with the supernatural once you start to figure out what's really going on. But I found a lot of it to be really effectively creepy. There's the very first opening bit is I had a pit in my stomach. I think the director Jason Yu does a really good job of building tension in a lot of these sequences and really focusing in on the weirdness and the horror of not being able to control your body when you sleep. And of course, sleeping is really necessary. And so there's that aspect of it. There's like a neighbor downstairs that is constantly complaining because there's so much banging happening upstairs. And it's this really small, intimate portrayal of this woman trying to kind of hold her family together while her husband is doing horrible things when he sleeps. And as the movie goes on, it's sort of like there's a trajectory where he is sleeping and she is sleeping less because she is afraid of what's going to happen when he sleeps. And so there's like this foil between the two of them where she is possibly going a little bit crazy because she's not sleeping. And he, whenever he does sleep, is acting out. So I really enjoyed it. I think it's coming out relatively soon, but I would recommend keeping your eye out for it. You saw this. What did you think?
I saw it at Fantastic Fest. Josh Korngut, friend of the show and Trent Central's managing editor, saw it at TIFF and had recommended it to me. He knew I was a big South Korea, Korean horror person. And overall, I liked it. I think I wish the conclusion had been a little bit different for me personally. Okay. I think for what I was, but I also, so again, grain of salt here. I saw it at Fantastic Fest, in the middle of the fest. I was there for a week. My brain was coming out of my ears. So I wanted a little bit more out of it. It's not going to pack the same Korean horror punch that maybe you would be expecting from a traditional, a more, what we have come to expect from Korean horror movies is bullshit, crazy, bleak, Jesus Christ, everything is terrible. And this movie kind of follows in that, but it's much more subdued and much more grounded, which I think a lot of people will like. If you think that sometimes Korean horror is just off the goddamn walls, this is much more grounded and much more domestic drama, but with weird horror elements, obviously. And I think
it's funny though too.
The couple is so good. The couple in this really feel like they're a couple. And
they do.
I think that's one of the biggest selling points of this movie is the chemistry between the couple makes this feel so real. And I think that's why it's so scary is if that chemistry wasn't there, I don't think it would have been nearly as effective. But I do like the way Jason Yu films in apartments and is able to make these small spaces feel so scary. I think that's a huge talent to be able to do that. And especially it's not trying to make, this is a very rich family that live in a very big house. They are showing the reality of a couple, new family trying to make it work, but they still live in a small apartment and have annoying neighbors. And it's the groundedness of it, I think, is what makes it unique. And while I wanted something a little bit more bonkers, again, I'll have to watch it when I'm not expecting something more bonkers. Yeah. I think that'll help. But it's definitely worth checking out. Again, like I said, I saw it and was expecting something different than what I got, which isn't a bad thing, but it kind of threw me off a little.
I can see that. It's also, relatively short for a Korean horror film. I mean, I'm used to seeing The Wailing and a bunch of movies that are, post over 2 hours, and this is a tight 95 minutes. But it does, I like what you're saying. I agree. I do think that it has some of the hallmarks that we expect in Korean genre films, where it is using humor and the tone changes a bit. It goes from, you know, being a kind of tight family drama to being something a little bit more supernatural to being funny. Like, there's, you can definitely see the elements that we're accustomed to seeing in a lot of Korean horror cinema that we get the option of seeing or the ability to see. But I agree. I think that I do think that this is not a movie that benefits from having a festival brain, for one, and also to go into it knowing that it's not going to be a bonkers Korean, South Korean horror film that you might be used to. I can absolutely see that for sure.
But it's coming out soon from Magnet, so people will be able to see it soon.
Yes, soon. Switching gears, I'm very excited to hear. I saw your tweet. I'm excited to hear about glowing TVs.
I fucking, those tweets are so funny. I wrote, okay, this is I Saw the TV Glow, Jane Schoenbrunn's new movie. And I tweeted a dumb, I just, you know, I do the thing that a lot of people who write about movies do, where they like tweet a quick reaction after they see something with four photos. Every time they blow up, I'm like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever written in my entire life.
Uh-huh.
My favorite is what's been happening recently is people are retweeting it and be like, how did you see it already? And I'm like, I don't even like, I can't even, no. Sorry, that sounds like so petty and like shitty, but whatever. Anyway, I saw the TV Glow last night, and dear listener, it fucks. It's so good. If you've been here a while, you know how much we both love, especially my love of We're All Going to the World's Fair, specifically emulating my childhood experiences of being alone on the internet, writing Neopets fan fiction on Neopets message boards, like Harry Potter fan fiction. Fuck J.K. Rowling, just saying that so we all know where I stand now as an adult. But I wrote a lot of Harry Potter fan fiction. I met Lindsay Lohan's sister on Neopets. I put that in scare quotes, everybody, because it was most definitely a catfish. But anyway, so I Saw the TV Glow is another piece of kind of nostalgia. Not porn, though, because Schoenbrunn is going very anti-nostalgia here, actually, which is actually very interesting. But it takes place over a series of decades, starting in 1996 with Owen, who is played by Justice Smith, who is a young boy. Justice Smith plays him when he's older. The younger version of himself in 1996 is played by a younger boy. But he is kind of drifting through life, and then learns about the show called The Pink Opaque, which is a show that Schoenbrunn made up for this movie. It is basically Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but also mixed in with some teen Nick shows like The Adventures of Pete and Pete, Are You Afraid of the Dark? It's got, and so there'll be interstitials of like VHS. It looks like it's a 4x3, grainy, has like the tracking stuff on it of VHS. Episodes of the show, or like clips of the show. So it's really cool. There's the show that like Schoenbrunn doesn't just talk about it, like she has episodes and all this stuff to go with it to make this feel like a real world. She has so much more budget this time, which is awesome. And he meets Maddie, who is played by, I have to pull up the name real quick, I apologize everyone. Maddie is played by Brigitte Lundy Payne. And the two of them form this, like, very tenuous relationship around The Pink Opaque. And it evolves into this story about, okay, the show is canceled, so what happens now? And it's about, like, their lives around the show, but also around the absence of the show. And it's a really beautiful look at a bunch of different things. But what really stuck out to me was, like, when you're a weird kid and you hyperfixate on something, and the feeling of relief when you find somebody who has the same hyperfixation as you or appreciates it and doesn't think you're weird. And like this show just captures the power of like TV and that kind of media for weird kids and how it can be really powerful in both positive and negative ways, and how being so latched onto that nostalgia to the point where like, so what this movie gets to that I've never really seen is the power of hyperfixation, and the but not just the power of hyperfixation, but the power of finding someone who loves your hyperfixation or will listen to you talk about it forever, and how that is both a really positive thing but also can be a really negative thing, and how nostalgia can be something dangerous, and like what that can do to you when you can't let go of something. And it's just like so smart and so weird, and it's so incredibly a allegory for being trans. But it doesn't talk about that, but it doesn't say like this is trans, but it just you pick up on it, especially like if you've ever had weird fucky gender feelings and you're neurodivergent and you're just like, I feel hollow as shit. Like, what is it? Like, I don't know how to feel whole. And like, what happens when you deny yourself the ability to feel whole again and all this stuff. And so like, it's just doing so much cool work in a weird way that's very much tapping into like liminal spaces and like analog horror aesthetics in a really fascinating way that I've never seen in a feature. And it's sad and it's weird and it's just like, I think just like Schoenbrunn is kind of a genius when it comes to encapsulating such ephemeral feelings and such difficult, complicated internal turmoil. And the way that they are able to make that flesh in a way with these movies is just absolutely fucking incredible to watch and to feel so seen by a movie like this again. Like, how did that happen a second fucking time? Like, it's so weird, but like, obviously Schoenbrunn and I have very similar childhoods, but it's like, I feel so distinctly like we share a brain sometimes, and the way that they're looking at the world and gender and relationships, parasocial relationships on the internet and like around fandom. And it's just like, it's so specific, but it's so interesting. Like, Danny Phantom, I watched that every second I could fucking get as a kid. Like, there were so many shows like I had, and I think because it's like specifically generational with like when I grew up, because I grew like, you know, like my generation, not even my generation, like my sub generation, like of like my like 30 to like, I don't know, like that kind of like 5 to 10 year age range where like we were growing up with the internet as like as it was developing, so were our brains. And some, I felt like my brain was developing alongside like social media. This movie like captures that. There's no social media in it, but like captures that kind of era that I lived in a way that I never see. And it's weird. I got really pissed in my screening because multiple men were like heaving heavy sighs while they were watching it.
Fuck them.
And I was like, I'm crying because I'm having a profound emotional experience about like the power and joy of finding friends who like love and adore you for all of you, like, your idiosyncrasies and don't judge you for your parents or whatever. And it just like brought me back to sleepovers and stuff and like the intimacy of friendship that is so powerful. Yeah, it's just like really good. It's definitely, oh god, excuse me, mess.com. It's just, it's incredible. Like, yeah, I could talk about this movie for so long. Like, I loved every second of it.
I can't wait to see it. I would love to get Jane on the podcast. I would love to see it.
It's out soon. You live near a draft house, Terry, so you'll probably get it.
Oh, I'm sure it's coming here. I really want to see it. I'm excited.
Incredibly, incredibly good cinema. It's really cool that like, not trying to lump all the trans artists together and try to make a monolith here, but like People's Joker is in theaters right now. Like,
yep.
I Saw the TV Glow is going to be in theaters. Like, there's just so much weird, cool cinema coming out right now from a lot of like trans and queer people that it's really exciting. Like, it's so fucking exciting. It's hard to feel excited sometimes because I feel like the real world does not reflect what is going on in cinema and like the celebrations of work going on in cinema. And it feels so hard to celebrate that in a world that is just like kind of on fire all the time and seems to hate anyone who's different. But like, it is kind of a shining beacon right now that there's so much cool art being made that's not just on the fringes anymore. Yeah. If anyone has seen Twin Peaks, The Return, this movie feels like that sometimes, because there are just moments that kind of feel like a music video, because like Jane Shonran just like has her favorite artist playing music and it just like all of a sudden it's just on them singing a song. And I was like, all right, fuck it. I like that. Oh, yeah. I always love when a show has a good, like, weird musical breakdown. So we're just following the trend. So yeah. It's a special one to me, at least. And I think a lot of people feel the same way. So
awesome. Yeah, I need to see it.
Highly recommend. It's hitting theaters in May.
Okay.
So get excited. This is so different, and I'm so excited because this is Mummies and Hot Cult Leaders.
Oh, what a cutie. The guy, Chad Westbrook
Hinds. Was not expecting it.
So cute. Okay, so we both saw The Ceremony Is About to Begin, which is a Panic Fest film, like Sleep was for me. They were both Panic Fest films for me. And The Ceremony Is About to Begin. I think that if I was like trying to compare it, it's found footage. It's a documentary-esque type movie, but it reminds me of sort of like if Creep and The Sacrament and monster movies all kind of like got together, because...
Oh, okay.
Because like most of the movie is about the documentarian who is at some weird compound with a man named Anubis, and they're having like a game of it reminds me of like the dynamics in Creep, where you're not quite sure where things are gonna go, and it's a little cringy and it's awkward and things just keep happening. But it also is like in a compound that is all about Osiris and ancient Egypt, and has like this long running ideology of which people have escaped, and I don't know, it's just it's very weird. There's definitely I don't think it 100% works, but I really enjoyed the performances between the two leads, played by Keith played by John Laird, and Anubis played by Chad Westbrook Hinds, who were both co-writers of the film with Sean Nichols Lynch, who's the director. And I don't know, it's like it's weird. It's a weird movie. It's definitely low key. It's a short 70 minutes, which I think works in its favor. It goes into some fun places towards the end. But it's just, it's a weird one. I'm not really sure what exactly 100% what to think about it, but I had a good time watching it for the most part. And you saw it too. Did you feel similarly?
Yeah. So I really like the comparisons that you make to The Sacrament and to Creep. It definitely has that vibe, because we start out with a guy making a documentary about an ex of his who has disappeared, and he is trying to find out where, and he interviews ex members of the group who all have Egyptian god nicknames, and they're sharing their experience with what is essentially a cult.
My favorite thing, though, speaking of which, with this Egyptian cult, is there's a quote where they're doing that kind of the documentary head talking type thing, and this guy who is very white says, "I think Egyptian culture is for everyone. He just happens to be white," about the cult leader. And that made me, between that and someone else being really confused because she went from a high rise to living in a yurt on this commune, and she's like, "What is your brand here, really?" I'm just like, this is targeting a very specific kind of person in a satiric way, and I love that. But sorry, I just
yeah. Oh no, I like that. I think that the movie doesn't lean into that as much.
No,
I think like not really a problem, but what I the kind of it tries to strike a balance between being funny and being creepy, and I think it's not always successful, and how especially when we go from it being the kind of pseudo documentary talking heads interviews to just the guy going to the farm compound whatever and capturing the footage. I think once we transition to the more traditional found footage route, it kind of loses that sense of humor and doesn't maintain it. And I also don't think it's scary quick enough for it to not feel jarring. I love where it goes in the third act. I mean, like, it's mummies, but like, we're not gonna spoil how it happens, but like, mummy found footage? Are you fucking kidding me? Like, hell fucking right if there's mummy found footage, motherfucker. And like, I just love, it's like kind of daring to be like what it, like to be what it is, and I love that. It's actually quite impressive, and I think that while the script isn't well paced, I think that's like how I feel about a lot of the Panic Fest movies this year, is that like they're not, all of them are like, they're short, they're, the script and the pacing are a little bit weird, but they're really trying something neat, and like I really fully respect people being like, yeah, fuck it, mummy found footage cult movie, yeah. And you know, this, that idea works for me, and I think that's why I liked it so much, is because the idea was really solid, and while the like the kind of plotting out of it isn't always the best,
the execution's not the greatest.
I was so invested. Yeah, but I was still so invested in the characters and like mm-hmm. the idea behind it that it's like you're able to overlook those flaws because you're so invested in the idea.
Yeah.
So that's a big strength to this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's mummy found footage. Come on.
Come on.
Yeah. There's some stuff that happens at the very end, like in the credits, that I wish had kind of been the vibe for the whole thing. Or
same.
At least had, you know what I mean?
Like, I do know what you mean. Without spoiling anything, I do know exactly what you mean. Because I felt again, the same thing. I was like, where it ended, I was like, I wanted more of that.
I really enjoyed it. I think it's smart, it's short, and it's different. It's so unique. So
mm-hmm.
I don't know when that is coming out into the world yet. But I have a feeling this is going to get picked up pretty quickly. You know, like, it's so unique, and it's, like, smart enough in its script that it's, like...
Weird, sad documentaries?
Yes. I'm going to vamp for a second so I can get the date that this publishes. So I can actually... And by publishes, I mean premieres? God damn, my brain is broken, everybody.
Okay. Oh my gosh. So, while you're vamping, I forgot that I wanted to talk about something else. I'm not gonna dive deep into it, but I will say that if you are fans of like Sandman, Dead Boy Detectives premieres this week. It's out by the time this episode drops. I've seen the first four episodes of it. It's by the co-creators, it's by people that worked on Sabrina. So if you're not into that sort of thing, you might not like this, but the characters in this are really funny, really great, and full of character. And I might talk about this a little bit more next week, but I just wanted to let you guys know it is out as of this episode, and I would recommend it. It's on Netflix. It's fun. Sorry.
Cool.
There's the vamp.
I love it. Okay, so this is a real weird one. Couple months ago, after Josh Korngut, once again shout out, went to the Toronto International Film Festival, for he is based in Toronto, he saw this documentary called The Contestant, and he kind of told me about it, and I was fascinated and excited to see it whenever it would come out, and lo and behold, I got an email that this is coming to Hulu on May 2nd. And when I tell you that this is one of the more troubling documentaries I've ever seen, you're gonna get, it's got big old boy vibes in a real fucked up sort of way. So
okay, I've never seen Old Boy, so don't spoil that one.
no, it's a old boy in the setup, so it's not gonna spoil anything else that happens, but like Old Boy starts out where he it is not spoilers for Old Boy at all.
Okay, I've been meaning to watch it. I have the 4K Blu-ray of it, and I need to sit down and watch it.
It's simply in the setup of Old Boy, which is like, again, it's the first like 15 whatever the fuck minutes. So anyway, The Contestant. So The Contestant is about a man in Japan who, as part of a game show that he wasn't fully aware about, was essentially left to live in a room naked for a year. And his task was, he was put in a room with nothing but some cushions and a rack of magazines. They took away his clothes and they said, all right, here you go. And The show was... I'm so sorry. I cannot... Oh, yeah. The show was called Denpa Shonen, A Life in Prizes. So Denpa Shonen was a popular Japanese television reality show. And for those of you who are not, like, super familiar with Japanese reality television, it's a ridiculous, crazy genre of show. Like, if you've seen GIFs online, of like, is it real or is it chocolate? People are walking around a set trying to, like, bite things with their mouths to see if they're real, if they're chocolate. Like, and this is for years that this has been, like, a thing in Japan. So, a reality show where a naked man sits in a room for a year was, like, not necessarily that upsetting to people. They were, like, young people were like, oh, what the fuck? This is so fascinating. And older generation was like, this is terrible. But the whole conceit here is this man who is nicknamed Nasubi due to his penis being out, and which means eggplant, and they censored it by putting an eggplant. He was being filmed by these cameras. He didn't know he was being filmed and broadcasted to the entire world. He was basically living naked for a year, filling out magazine sweepstakes to win prizes, and that was the only way that this motherfucker could get food, was he almost starved to death because he didn't win anything that he could eat, and then he finally won some stuff. And then basically it was like, okay, so now the goal is, like, they set all of these goals for him that he had no idea what he was doing. He just knew that he had to fill out these things and get prizes, and he was, like, being filmed, but he didn't know what that footage was being used for, and he didn't really know, like, what, like, the goalpost was. And this documentary is about his experience, and it's about him telling his story. It's not trying to be sensational. It's really him talking about, like, what was going on in his head while this was going on, and it also interviews the producer who did this, and the producer who actually apologized before the documentary started, and, like, used the documentary as a way to apologize to Nasubi for basically ruining his life. And so the documentary is this, like, harrowing look at human rights violations, like, being broadcasted on television.
Jesus Christ.
But, like, here's the thing. It was, like, culturally fine because, and this is not knocking Japan, it was just, like, part of, like, popular culture. And so, were these game shows, and, like, this one took it a step too far. It was this producer kind of trying to be, like, okay, like, what do we do to get the, it was, like, you know, again, what do we do to get the ratings? And, I mean, like, the most unethical thing you could ever possibly imagine, and yet, like, so many people watched it and, like, consumed it. It's like it predates the Truman Show. It predates, like, a lot of reality TV. It, like, there's even a, it kind of reminds me of Perfect Blue, but, like, this happened in 1998. So, yeah, he basically became this, like, the most famous television personality in Japan, and he had no idea. And it's, like, telling the story of, like, how he learned it and how they fucked with him. Like, flew him to Korea and flew him back and made him think he had done it. And then they made him live through, like, it is literally the most upsetting thing. This poor man was essentially psychologically tortured for, like, years for entertainment purposes.
Jesus.
So, it's got, like, the most... I actually got to interview him yesterday. Literally the most positive person on the planet.
Aww.
It's actually quite incredible how the story ends for him. It's quite inspiring, but also, like, harrowing.
Right.
So, it's a documentary. It's just a documentary. It's, like, an hour and 40 minutes, I think. So, it's not a show. It's just, like, a standard documentary. It's coming to Hulu. It's definitely a sensational topic, but they do a really good job trying to ground it, so it's not, there isn't any extra sensationalizing going on around it other than the episodes. Like, the stuff, like, the episodes that are presented and, like, all of that is kind of just presented as it is, and then it grounds it with, you know, Nasubi talking about his experience doing that. And so it's not, I don't even know, I could keep saying this, but I don't know how else to say it. Like, it's not trying to sensationalize a topic right. that's already so sensational. It's trying to be more respectful about it rather than trying to, like, make it an even bigger deal. And when I interviewed him, he said, I did this because everyone wants to be like, well, why don't you sue? Why don't... And it's, like, very confrontational. And but he wanted to do this documentary because she wanted to hear his story through his words and, like, his thoughts, not, like, asking him why he didn't do something. And it was more trying to just, like, respect his emotions that he experienced.
Wow.
So I found it quite... I mean, it's awful, but also it's a very interesting example of how to tell a story like that in the best way possible by giving the person who went through it a voice again. Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, I saw the email for that, and I was like, oh, this sounds wild.
It is. It's really good.
That's good. I might have to check it out.
I would. It's like... So it's one of those things that it's like, it's really upsetting, but it's also mm-hmm. like, it's not trying, like I said, to make it like ultimate disturbing. It's more just like, what is going on in your head when you experience something like this? And like really understanding what that kind of isolation does to a person and then revealing, getting that shit thrown in your face that people have been watching you at like your most fucking like... base form. I'm sorry. I can't. It's another one that I watched. That, like, I can't. I was like, I could talk about it for so long because it's just like
swinging wildly from that.
staying in the realm of television, but like real different.
I on a rewatch of the very first episode of season 3, I was like, oh, I have thrown Mary Beth into the deep end with this one because there are. Jack is no longer in charge of NBC when this starts. There is a man named Devin Banks who shows up in the first season that was not an episode we talked about, who is sort of Jack's gay nemesis. Devin Banks marries Kathy Geiss. Kathy Geiss is the daughter of Mr. Geiss, who runs GE. And so she is now in charge because he is in a coma. And so, like, all of this has happened previously. And so by the time this episode starts, Jack has come from a job working for the government where he meets Matthew Broderick, who plays a character named Cooter. And he is now trying to get back into being in charge of NBC while Liz is also seeking approval for adopting a baby. And so that is the setup going into the season. And I apologize because I was like, oh, there's so much going on that she probably is like, what the fuck is happening?
Yes. A lot of my notes were like, what? Huh? Who?
Kathy Geiss, though, is queen. I love her so much.
Okay, I've seen Kathy Geiss before. Well, who is that actress? I've seen her.
She was in, I believe... If I'm remembering correctly, I think she was in the Leftovers.
Shit! Oh my god! No!
I could be mistaken. Her name is Marceline Hugo. Hugo?
She's the one that has the worst death of all time in The Leftovers that made me like I had a panic attack.
Really?
She's the one. Have you seen The Leftovers?
I've seen the first season. I don't remember a whole lot about it. Gladys. She was Gladys in The Leftovers.
So episode, like, 3 or something, she gets her fucking head, like, bashed in with rocks.
Jesus.
And, like, it was, like, the most viscerally violent but, like, real-feeling death I've ever seen. And that explains why she looks familiar. But also, I don't know why... But the specific image of her putting her hand on Jack's leg is, like, an image I have in my brain as a memory. I don't know why.
That's
or
weird.
How. No. When did this... Hold on.
This came out October 30th of 2008.
If I'm doing my math correctly, Hold on, when did I graduate high school? This is important. I'm sorry. I'm like, I hit my pen and I'm trying to do math and it's like, it's impossible. I graduated in 2011. 2008. Yes! Okay. This is so funny. Oh my god, this is... I have just unlocked like six in real layers. Time. Like, yeah, I'm keeping this in for everyone to listen to me literally piece together memories of my high school dating life before I dated the worst men ever. I dated this guy named Jose Molina. He was such a nice boy, Dominican. His mom was, like, crazy, but that's fine. Like, she was nice. He loved 30 Rock, and he would always watch 30 Rock with a specific group of people, and I think I watched this with them.
Jesus.
He was the first guy to ever touch my boobs.
Oh.
Yeah, I was the first guy to ever feel me up underneath my bra.
Wow.
I hate, you know what? I hate you because I have this fucking 30 Rock bullshit has put to... I hate you.
You have had, like, a couple of realizations while watching these episodes.
I had another one with the next episode! I hate you! I literally... Terry, I was at happy hour eating oysters with my friend today, like, 2 hours ago. And he was like, yeah, do you ever, like, think of, like... He was talking about, like, how he was, like, similar to a character... now as an adult. And I was like, yeah, you know what I just recently realized? I'm Liz Lemon. Like, I said, I have been rewatching, literally explained how I've been rewatching 30 Rock for the podcast. And I said, I have realized in my now job and where I am in my life, for the most part, I'm Liz Lemon.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to feel about that. And it was solidified with the next episode we're going to talk about. And oh. I'm just like, I can't.
Okay, that's hilarious because...
It's not a bad thing, but it's also like, oh my god, I never... It's just funny. I don't know what it is, but it's
the next,
like,
episode solidified, yeah, that I am also Liz Lemon. Like, my old Twitter account before I created the Gaily Dreadful one says the male Liz Lemon, and it is because of this one of the episodes we're going to talk about today. I think that's hilarious. I think it's hilarious. But okay, before we talk about Gavin Velour, because I have things I want to talk about.
Yeah.
What did you think of the do-over?
I went aside... off of a deep end.
No, I am so glad you did. That was hilarious. I am curious what you thought about the do-over, given that you don't realize all the stuff that was going into this episode.
I did write, what is happening with Jack, especially when he shows up in the male uniform? I'm looking at my notes on my phone. Little creepers. Obsessed with everything, because here we are both, it's Liz is like, someone is coming, someone aka Bev, played by Megan Mullally, who looks like who also looks kind of like Tina Fey, and they look like the same person this whole episode. It's fucking hysterical.
But do you ever run a sex cam ring out of your apartment, Liz? How often do you entertain gentlemen sex guests?
And it's her visiting the office, which we all know is just destined for failure.
Mm.
And it's just a beautiful nightmare. Well, also Jack is trying to fight back for the company. I love Will Arnett. It's no longer G&E. It's just G. Samsung bought it. They are now Samsung. And then he scrambles up the rock like a toddler. Just something about whenever someone just says something and then scrambles up some kind of rock face or, like, a hill, something about that is just so deeply comedic to me. I don't know. Like, I get why, but it just tickles me in a way that I can't truly explain. When someone just, like, says something and then goes, okay, and then just, like, becomes an animal. It's just, and Will Arnett is so good at that, like, with his body.
He is. Keep your friends close and your enemies so close that you're almost kissing. Are Colin Firth movies erotica, though? That's what I want to know. Can they be considered erotica? I hear the man can wear a sweater.
Yes. To answer seriously, yes. Have you seen that little man in his Love Actually sweater?
Oh, my yeah, God. It's true.
My God. And then I wrote, of course she dated O.J. Simpson. This is when Jenna is being interviewed. This is when all the interviews are happening individually, which of course are a shit show. Love Pete talking about shooting one of his coworkers with an arrow.
Yep, that was another episode too.
Yeah, I was like, I didn't have context for that, but it made me laugh. Judah Friedlander's fucking hat, going from the fucking trucker hat to the bowler hat that says horny. Are you kidding?
I love him in his hats.
We haven't talked about them.
No.
But I had to mention it now because they love it. I just love a good, like, okay, we've continued the joke in the most ridiculous way. And it just tickles me. It tickles me.
This also generated one of my favorite gifts to use, which is Kathy Geist looking at the screen going, kiss, kiss, kiss! I use that as a gif for reaction when there are two hot boys all the time. And I love it so much.
Oh, there's more. Oh, God, I missed the rest of my notes. I'm so sorry. Tracy saying, Liz and I go way back, like spinal cords and car seats.
Yeah.
Once again, just Tracy saying the most absolutely, like, the craziest fuck shit I've ever heard in my entire life. And I'm obsessed. But then I also was a little bit, like, poor Jack. Jack shares a little bit of his trauma, and I just felt a little sad. Like, I used to walk 4 miles to the country club because mother told me golf was a gentleman's sport. And, like, all of the things he's done as a child to be successful, and you just, like, kind of feel bad for him for a minute.
Yeah.
Get a little, again, like, we haven't got... the ones I have seen, I don't get a lot of access into what's going on in that brain.
No.
So.
No.
And then I just wrote Kathy Geist help as my final note for this episode. Because she... this is the part where she walks in to Kathy, like, pulling off his shoes or something, and they're watching soap opera, and
the unicorn is placed strategically on his groin, which is a detail that I love so much.
Yes.
But then also the line I thought you would single out was the point when they're talking about not being the worst people. They're like, we might not be the best people, but we're not the worst. Graduate students are the worst.
They are. And then Liz's a cute line about, like, this is my weirdo family, and, like, it's kind of a sweet moment of being like, oh, found family. And then they beat her until she's unconscious.
Do over. I get a do over. All right, Gavin Velour, because we are running really long tonight, but Gavin Velour, I want to hear. Because, all right, the reason why I'm gonna explain the reason why I realize that in this episode that I am Liz Lemon is two things. One, when she's talking about how she doesn't want to go anywhere and how she's away from her toilet and it's a stressed about an away toilet situation, is me. And
we've
two,
we literally had that discussion several times.
Oh,
when
we sure
stay
have
together in hotels.
We sure have. There's that. And then the second line is where Liz is like, she doesn't want to date anyone. She's like, I wish I could just start a relationship about 12 years in, sit around, goof on TV shows, and we all go to bed and no one tries any funny business. Like, at that moment, I'm like, oh my God, I have never been more seen. And that line right there is why on my previous Twitter account, I was the male Liz Lemon. Is because of this episode. And then also, I quote with my gaming friends all the time, I miscounted the men, Liz, whenever something bad happens or a character dies while we're playing and I'm like dying with my friends. I'm always shouting, I miscounted the men. So this episode is very special for me because of that. And then it also has a sex doll of Tracy.
The Tracy that he puts in his bed and tricks his son, and then his son is like, I'm having a bed.
He thinks his kids are going to Menendez him. He's like, don't Menendez me.
So funny.
All right. So why is it that you is it the line about the relationship 12 years in?
Yes, because that's literally what my relationship is with my husband. And I'm not like trying to be like, hey, flex. It's more just like, I don't have original experience in my entire life. And like, I truly have just like, I've been with my husband for 12 years this year.
Well, dang.
Yeah, what the fuck? What the fuck? Yeah, it's going to be 12 because. I don't know if you. But she said that, and I was like, aw, that's kind of nice. And, like, it just made me laugh even more just to be, like, solidifying that, like, truly and always I was destined to be a Liz Lemon type. And it's not, I used to, like, when I watched this, like, with my, like, high school boyfriend and his friends, it was always like, oh, she's so lame. And then now I'm like, nah, dude. She actually is, like, she's a caricature of an adult, but it's not like she is the most. It's like, you know, when you talk about like, what do you want to see with like one normal person and a bunch of Muppets? This show is her with a bunch of Muppets. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, she's the only like.
I love that.
Real person to me, you know, like mm-hmm. She feels more grounded to me as a character and everyone else feels like a joke. Like even Jack does, like he's. Mm-hmm. And so again, like I see this as like. Yeah, she's like, there's satirical stuff about her being an adult, but at the same time, like, it's incredibly relatable as you become an adult, and you're like, Especially, again, like, I've said this a million times talking about it, but, like, being a woman working in media and, like, being in a higher-up position, it's just like, oh. And it's not, and I don't think it's a bad thing at all, it just makes me feel very grown up in a way that kind of freaks me out.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Oh, you know, it totally does. It totally does.
I'm like, oh my god. Like, I've been living on my own for a decade. Like, I'm married. I have cats. But, like, for some reason, this is being, like, I'm, like, almost 31. But I'm, like, oh, my God. And somehow this show is making me confront that in a way that I was just absolutely not expecting.
I know.
By any stretch of the imagination. I'm, like, is 30 Rock going to force me into an existential crisis? So, thank
you. Also, finally, the more and more I watch this, the more I do love Tracy Morgan in this. And the line that kills me every single time is the moment when he believes his kids are going to kill him because he watched the program on the Menendez brothers, right? And they killed their father. And so he puts the sex doll in his bed and he's watching from the closet. To, like, you know, trick them. And the kid is basically like, I don't want you to leave, Dad. I had a nightmare. And he jumps out and the kid starts hitting him. He's like, stop patriciding. It's such a funny line. it's my favorite.
It's so funny because it's like Tracy is like one of the smarter people on this show. But you don't think so. But like he's actually quite smart in a way.
Yeah.
Like, he's book smart in a way, but not street. I don't know how to describe it because it's like he's intelligent, but not smart. I also just like feel Liz Lemon so hard, especially when Steve Martin as Gavin Velour calls and he's like, I suppose this is a booty call. And she's like, oh, before she's like, oh, are there another party? He's like, no. And she's like, oh.
I guess this is what the kids call a booty call. And he's like, I haven't been out of my house. And even I know it. The kids don't say that anymore.
I'll get the helicopter and take you to the train station. Yeah. It's a good episode, though. Again, very much solidifies. Yeah, so, sorry, y'all. We ran long. There's just so many things to talk about. Did. But we are... What are we doing? Who am I? Anyway, where am I going next in 30 Rock? What new existential crisis will I have next week, Terry?
All right, so we are continuing in season 3 with episodes 8, Flu Shot, which is a zany episode that I absolutely love, of course, otherwise we wouldn't be watching it. And then episode 10, Generalissimo, which has an unfortunate case of brown face in it. I'm just gonna
well
put that the... like it's funny, but also it's like, ooh, I think you could have got someone else to play this character. So there is that. So I will just warn that off the top, because as I said, some of the episodes do not age well, but there are some really great moments in this episode, and which is why I still think it's one of my favorites.
Steve had a really scary me, like, on the Wii, that I think was named Generalissimo, and I'm just giggling.
Are you talking about Signore?
Oh, Signore, not Generalissimo? Who the fuck am I?
There was Signore, and then when I tried to remake him, it was Parmigio.
Oh, Parmigio, okay.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, anyway, there's no explanation for that other than, yeah.
All right, so that's where we're going next. And Purpurina says, "God damn, Steve's hearing super fucking power shit."
I did text him. I did text him. I didn't want to yell on mic, so I texted him, but then he yelled back. So,
All right.
It's not as loud if you yell.
So that is where we're going for the little cuts. But Mary Beth, oh my fucking God, who are we talking with on Monday?
On Monday, we are chatting with Brad and Fiona Dourif.
What? Chucky. Motherfuckers. Chucky.
What? So, we chat about Chucky. All things Chucky. And then I also ask about his time playing Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings, because I had to.
And of course.
We are talking about Grim Prairie Tales. And Fiona specifically is sharing why this film starring her father terrified her growing up. First time we've had a person who is in a Scarred for Life pick on the show.
It was really fun also kind of going through his experience in the movie. The movie is not readily available, but there is a really shitty copy on YouTube. This is a movie that I think...
Horror Western anthology.
Yeah.
It's actually like... I think it's worth watching for sure. It's weird, but there's some like really cool stuff, cool effects. This is like right, we talk about this, but it's like ripe for like a Vinegar Syndrome or like Severin like re-release 4K thing, because it's Brad Dourif and James Earl Jones literally telling stories around a campfire.
A man gets sucked up into a woman's vagina. There you go. Go watch it.
Yep. Cool. Same? What, Tony? This doesn't make any fucking sense. If you're referencing at least the man being sucked into a vagina. Anyhoozle. So listeners, you've heard from us, but we want to hear from you. Do you watch anything that we watched this week and have thoughts? Do you have any thoughts about other 30 Rock episodes I need to watch? You can let us know by sending us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com. And you can also follow us on the internet. I am at mbmcandrews on Twitter and at mb.mcandrews on Instagram.
And I'm a Gaily Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, you better be following the podcast. We are at Scarred Podcast on X/Twitter and Blue Sky. I don't know why I called it X. That's terrible of me. And we are at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, we are on Patreon.
I don't know if the Rondo Mary Awards Beth will have been announced by now, but keep an eye on our social media to see if anything happened. Oh my god, my cat is the cutest shit right now. Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. My ADHD medication is wearing off. I apologize. Thank you everyone for listening out there. Please stay safe. But most importantly, stay creepy.
Until next time. Oh, we're so-